Hello and welcome to Martian Drive-In Podcast 140. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're looking at the career of one actor who died very early. That actor is Laird Cragar, and the two movies I'm going to talk about are his 1944 film The Lodger, which also stars Merle Oberon and George Sanders, and a movie that was released posthumously, the 1945 thriller Hangover Square, also starring George Sanders, Linda Darnell. So let me get the contact details out of the way and we can get the show started. Martian Drive-In Podcast is a fortnightly podcast of science fiction, horror, fantasy, film appreciation. It doesn't matter when it comes from, whether it's old or new, in black and white, in color, 3D, anamorphic. It doesn't matter. If it's interesting, I'm going to give it a go. Now, there are occasionally also roundtable discussions where I get a few like-minded cronies around and we talk about science fiction or horror or fantasy or anything that takes our mind. So the format's kind of loose. Now, you can contact me and leave feedback via feedbackpaleo, that's feedback, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com. You can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook and have a chat there with me and other people about science fiction, fantasy, horrors, or any other kind of things you want to talk about. Apart from politics, I've got another area for that. Okay, so how's everybody doing? We kind of find here spring is on the brink, which is kind of nice, but Australia's been going through a really weird week. Some of you may be aware of it, some of you may not. But I'm going to drift into politics here to just kind of give an explanation, because a few people on Facebook have asked me what the fuck was happening with Australian politics this week. And here's what's happening. I'll give you the skinny, a full story, and I'm rubbing my hands together. You can probably hear it, sorry. The full story is this. Rupert Murdoch is a cunt. That's the first part of it. He owns a lot of the media here in Australia, a ridiculous amount, and he shouldn't. And because basically he is what I said he was before. So what happened is this. The Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, who's a Conservative Prime Minister, ex-merchant banker, very, very wealthy man, owns a fantastically beautiful harbourside mansion, and is part member of the Liberal Party, which is a badly named political party. It should be called the Conservative Wanker Party or something like that. But anyway, he wasn't popular with the other members of Parliament in the Liberal Party for a few reasons. One, Rupert Murdoch told them not to like him. And Rupert Murdoch, along with a few other mining magnates like Gina Reinhart and Twiggy Forrest, basically runs the government. Let's not kind of mince words about that. So what happened was they started to get a groundswell to throw Turnbull out as Prime Minister. Now, the Prime Minister of Australia is not elected directly by the people. He or she, hopefully more she's in the future, is elected by the members of the government party. It's kind of like England does the same thing. It's a confusing thing to Americans and other people with really baroque and arcane political systems. But so what happened was they started getting a petition together. They took it to a vote in the party room in Parliament, and it lost. Now, here's the thing about votes against the Prime Minister in a political party room. There's a rule of two. The first one always fails, the second one always succeeds. So Turnbull decided what he was going to do was to demand 43 signatures from government MPs, from Liberal MPs, which is about half of a quorum, and he wanted it within 24 hours. So they gave it to him. And he got dumped. And the person they wanted to put in, the person behind this, is an ex-Queensland policeman called Peter Dutton, who is not the loveliest person you're ever going to see. He's a nasty right-wing demagogue. He was thrown out of the Queensland Police Force allegedly for joyriding in a police van around various parts of Brisbane, with a bunch of incarcerated Aboriginal teenagers in the back of the van. He didn't give a shit about them. He just wanted to go joyriding. So he did, and he was asked to leave very quietly the Queensland Police Force. He's also the person who runs Australia's offshore immigration camps in Nauru and Papua New Guinea, which are essentially concentration camps. There's no kind of two ways about it. There are teenagers trying to commit suicide. One of them is trying to set themselves on fire. It's a national shame, and it's a national tragedy, and it's more so for the refugees than for us. Now, the raison d'etre of that particular policy is that the government says that if they keep those people offshore and treat them nastily in those camps, then other refugees won't try to come to Australia by boat, which is a non-trivial task because you've got to cover thousands of kilometres of quite rough ocean to get here. That's their idea. It doesn't actually pan out in reality. The stats and the research don't support it, but it is the policy of both the government and the Labor Party, which is in opposition at the moment. The reason they use to justify it is that a lot of people died in boats trying to get to Australia. They drowned. So in order not to drown people, their idea is to scare them so much by running a couple of concentration camps, one on Nauru, which is a tiny island in the Pacific, not too far from Palau, and another one on the Papua New Guinea island of Manus. Anyway, I'm digressing into kind of nasty areas. So what happened was I had the second vote, and it turns out that Peter Dutton didn't win. Another guy called Scott Morrison won, who's slightly better, but not much. Now, the interesting thing about Scott Morrison is he's a Pentecostal Christian. He's a happy clapper. And he also has a deep and irrational belief in what's called prosperity theology. You know, like if you believe in God and you do good things, you'll become wealthy, which kind of works for people who tell other people that if you believe in God and do good things, you'll become wealthy. I'm allowed to say that because I've got half a dozen family members who are in that kind of a cult. So that's the current situation. We got a change of prime minister, and it was all about an internal political party's ructions against Malcolm Turnbull, the incumbent at the time. They basically churned the country around because of an internal scrag fight between several politicians and a media magnate. It had nothing to do with running the government. There were a whole bunch of really important bits of legislation that were put on hold for weeks because of this bullshit. And the Australian public knows it. And the Liberal Party, along with their coalition partners in the National Party, are tanking in the polls. They're really getting a whack because of this. Now, we've got an election that's due in the next 6 or 8 months. So hopefully we'll get someone a political party, a little less hardcore and a little less lacking in compassion. I'm not particularly in love with the Labor Party because of their asylum seeker policy, but they do have a lot of progressive social policies as well. And I would hope that those would help to improve the self-image and the lives of people in Australia. So that's what's been happening this week in Australia. Well, in the last week in Australia. Total clusterfucker. Because I'm home now and not working, I could kind of blow this by watching it all on TV. And it was a really kind of uncomfortably odd drama to live through because nobody wanted it to happen. The political commentators of all stripes, except for the ones who are beholden to Rupert Murdoch, said that it was a big mistake and it was a clusterfuck and a dumpster fire and everything else negative they could possibly say without getting sued. But it turns out that that's what happened. Anyway, I was watching movies as well, oddly enough, and I put up a YouTube video about the clusterfuck that happened as well. You can go to my YouTube channel, which has got me putting a whole bunch of visuals together with the song Comedy Tonight from A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. I'll put a link in the show notes so you can get to that video. And if you like, subscribe to my YouTube channel. I'm also doing one for Australian Father's Day this week, where I'm looking at the 5 worst fathers in movie genre history. Now, I'm not doing the obvious ones. I'm doing a little bit oblique. But I'll put a video on that before the end of this week as well. So I've got a little bit of work to do this week, but it's stuff I love doing and it's a lot of fun. And every time I edit a new video, I learn a lot about the process of video editing. So now it is time for
What has Terry been watching?
Okay, so what have I been watching? I'm continuing to watch anime a bit. I'm watching the fourth season, I think it is, of Yu-Gi-Oh! Because I didn't watch it previously. And it's a very long season, full of drama and magic and mystery and all sorts of other things that you get in most anime. Yes, I'm enjoying that. Let me have a look at my letterbox to get the movies that I've been watching. There have been a few. There's a movie that was on Amazon Prime called The Creep Behind the Camera, which is about a total nutcase in the late 1950s, early 1960s, who directed a movie called The Creeping Terror. It's kind of done in a reenactment style, and they do interview a lot of the people that were around for the making of this film, and it's kind of a very, very weird documentary. If you're into horror films of that vintage, I recommend it, but it's very, very lateral and very strange as well. So I can't say I really enjoyed it because I don't think it's quite up to that standard, but it was kind of okay. I watched one of the movies that was a precursor to The Dirty Dozen, which was a Roger Corman film called The Secret Invasion, which had Stuart Granger, Ralph Valone, Mickey Rooney, Ed Burns and Henry Silver in it. And it's actually not too bad. It was filmed in Dubrovnik, which is now in Croatia. And it's a kind of medieval city. There are lots of tiled roofs and things like that. And it's actually not too bad, given the fact that it had a fairly limited budget. It's a nice little kind of lowish budget 1960s war movie, and not up there with really big ones like The Great Escape and Kelly's Heroes and The Dirty Dozen and The Guns of Navarre and that kind of thing. But it's not too bad. If you're a bit of a Roger Corman completist, you might want to check out The Secret Invasion, made in 1964. Then, because Sally is the biggest shark movie geek in the universe, we watched Sharknado 6, It's All About Time, which is the last of the Sharknado movies. The whole six movies come to a close. It's not the best in the series, I'll be honest with you about that. It's got some weird shit in it. The special effects are slightly better than they have been in previous ones. But again, you get sharks, again, you get tornadoes. You get some really weird casting in historical characters because the heroes travel through time to beat Sharknadoes all through history. And if you're a Sharknado completist, which Sally definitely is, it's a good one to watch, but I think that there's not much fuel left in the tank by this one, and so it's probably a good place to end that series, though people can argue that the best place to end that series was with the first movie. So I watched a late 1950s science fiction film, one of the low-budget jobbies that usually went to drive-in cinemas, Fiend Without a Face, which I hadn't seen. It had Marshall Thompson in it and nobody else that you know. I think it was filmed in England, but it was one of those English science fiction movies of a certain time where, in order to accommodate all the accents involved, they said it was filmed in Canada. It was set in Canada, sorry. And it's got some really cool brain monsters with big tentacle spines sticking out of them and antennas who, for really ropey science fiction reasons, are created and attack a military base in Canada. The best bits are the last 10 minutes where they actually get a mass attack by these brain monsters and people are shooting them and lots of goo is gushing out of them. The rest of it's a little bit slow, but the last 10 minutes of this film is a lot of fun to watch when they blow the fuck out of and axe and tomahawk all of these brain monsters. So basically skip through the film till you get to the bit where they start seeing the monsters, which previously are invisible for reasons best known to the makers of the movie. Fiend Without a Face has a nice ending. The last 10 minutes of it is pretty fucking special. So then I went on to a Larry Cohen film I hadn't seen before, and it was the cast that got me. It was filmed immediately after Cue the Winged Serpent, and its special effects, which is a kind of almost unknown Larry Cohen film, starring Eric Bogosian and Zoe Lund, which mashes together a bunch of different films. It's got a little bit of Vertigo in it. It's got a little chunk of Rear Window. It's got a whole bunch of, it's a very unusual film. There's a lot more nudity in it than there has previously been in most of the Larry Cohen films that I saw. And Zoe Lund, who was the woman under a different name, who was in Abel Ferrara's Miss 45, plays a dual role in the film in a kind of Vertigo-y twist to the plot, We get Eric Bogosian at his peak playing a mad filmmaker. And, yeah, it's filmed in New York City, partly in wintertime. Looks like they also filmed it several months later because suddenly all of the snow has gone from the ground. So they may have had a long shoot and maybe Cohen had trouble getting the money together. But, if you're a Larry Cohen completist, like I said about the Sharknado movies, you'll want to see this one. It's got some deep and disturbing plot twists to it and a nice ending. The ending doesn't really kind of announce itself loudly, but it's pretty fucked up and twisted if you look at it exactly the right way. But Larry Cohen's special effects you should definitely check out if you're a Cohen fan. I also watched Ernst Lubitsch's Heaven Can Wait, which I've seen before, but I watched it because Laird Kruger, the subject of this week's podcast, played the devil in it. And he's a pretty damn fine devil. Two people steal this movie. The first one is Laird Kruger playing the devil in the front and the end before the flashback that makes up most of the film happens. They steal it from Gene Tierney and Don Ameche and all the others. And the other person is Charles Coburn, who plays Don Ameche's character's grandfather. Both he and Laird Kruger steal the movie for me. It really is. It's a Lubitsch film, so it's very kind of wry and arch and kind of amused look at human nature and the life of a man. It's got a very European sensibility, as often Lubitsch's films made in America did. And it's in beautiful, super-saturated Technicolor, which is not a bad thing at all. So I enjoyed rewatching that. And then I watched a movie I may have seen before, but I don't think I have, called The Marseille Contract, which is an action film from the 1970s, starring Michael Caine, Anthony Quinn, and James Mason, along with Alexandra Stewart and a bunch of French and Italian actors. It's one of those kind of co-production deals to do with heroin smuggling. Michael Caine plays an assassin for hire who's hired by a drug enforcement agency boss, played by Anthony Quinn, to kill James Mason's character, who is a drug smuggler. It's got lots of production values. There's a really nice car chase sequence, which was choreographed and filmed by Remy Julien, who was the master of French car chases. So that's got that in it. It's a little bit dated feeling and is a little bit, some of the action sequences and the editing don't quite come together very well. But it's worth checking out if you're in the mood for that kind of thing. It's got a nice little Roy Budd soundtrack to it and it's very much of its time. So anyway, I'm going to take a break now and when I get back, I'm going to talk about the career of Laird Kruger, and I'll probably just merge in The Lodger and Hangover Square. There's a lot in common between the two of them, not just Kruger himself, but George Sanders also stars in both of them in benign roles, which was a little unusual for George Sanders in later days. But I'll just play a little bit from the career of Laird Kruger, just to give you a feel for the guy.
Oh, here you are, George.
We were beginning to wonder what had happened to you.
You didn't come home last night, did you?
Oh, no. I stayed with some friends.
How did you get that cut?
Oh, I bumped into a man carrying some baskets a little while ago.
We have a little excitement outside.
But they're waiting for Kitty. She'll be leaving in a few minutes.
I'm going out, too. I shan't be in for dinner tonight. Oh, do you like my new ulster?
Oh, yes. If you don't mind, I'll wait to take down the glass.
If I seem a little excited tonight, you will understand why. If you've ever worked for a long time, long and dangerously, you know how it feels when you believe that in a little while... in a little while, you'll finish what you have to do.
You're referring to your work?
Yes.
You mean you're going away?
Perhaps, I don't know. I rather think I may.
How do you do, Mr. Van Cleve?
Good afternoon, Your Excellency. Very kind of you to receive me.
Not at all. Oh, please sit down.
Thank you.
I hope you'll forgive me, but we're so busy down here.
Really, sometimes it looks as if the whole world is coming to hell.
Frankly, I haven't had an opportunity to familiarize myself with your case. When did it happen, Mr. Van Cleve?
Tuesday. To be exact, I died at 9:36 in the evening.
I trust you didn't suffer much.
Oh, no, no, not in the least. I'd finished my dinner.
A good one, I hope.
Oh, excellent, excellent. I ate everything the doctor forbade. And then, well, to make a long story short, shall we say, I fell asleep without realizing it. And when I awakened, there were all my relatives speaking in low tones and saying nothing but the kindest things about me. Then I knew I was dead.
I presume your funeral was satisfactory.
So there are three clips of Laird Craigar. The first one was from The Lodger. The second one, I believe, was from Hangover Square. And the third one was from Heaven Can Wait. Interesting actor. He was a very tall and, for most of his career, quite corpulent man with strong features and dark hair and piercing blue eyes. And he was a very, very fine actor. He did a number of other roles too, which were kind of interesting. He played the pirate Henry Morgan in The Black Swan with Tyrone Power. He was in Blood and Sand with Power, where he played a quite outrageously gay bullfighting fan. Blood and Sand was a bullfighting movie that Fox did with Tyrone Power in it. And he made, of course, Heaven Can Wait, where he played His Excellency the Devil. The Lodger, which is a remake of a movie that had been made a couple of times. It was based on a stage play about Jack the Ripper, where he played Mr. Slade, the mysterious character who turns out to be Jack the Ripper. And in 1945, Hangover Square, where he plays the mentally ill composer George Harvey Bone. Now, Craigar was well-respected. Apparently, he was a lovely guy. He was quite amusing. He was well-regarded. He did an Oscar Wilde play on the stage in California, in Los Angeles, which was incredibly well-regarded by both critics and by the studios. In fact, that's the play that got him a contract with 20th Century Fox. And as I've said, it's a very short career. The only role for which Laird Craigar got top billing was his last one, the posthumous one in Hangover Square. In the other ones, he got third billing. In The Lodger, he gets third billing after Merle Oberon and George Sanders, who were much bigger stars at the time, even though his character is the focal point of the whole deal. The Lodger is actually based on a novel by Marie Belloc Lowndes and a play by the same person called Who Is He? Now, it's been filmed, it was filmed before 1944. It was filmed as a silent film, The Lodger, A Story of the London Fog, directed by Alfred Hitchcock. And there was also a sound version in 1932. It was remade twice after this film. The first time as Man in the Attic with Jack Palance in 1953. And in 2009, David Adaji did a version of it as well. Let me have a look and see what I can find out about that one. It's actually set in Los Angeles, oddly enough. It's got Alfred Molina, Rachel Lee Cook, Mel Harris, Shane West, and Philip Baker Hall, and Rebecca Pidgeon, who is the wife of David Mamet. So now, of course, I'm going to have to see that one too. That's one of the problems with doing these podcasts about often remade movies. You've got to go down the rabbit hole eventually and watch all the remakes. It's an obsession with me at times. But The Lodger, the 1944 one, let's get back to focus. The 1944 Lodger, I like a lot. We don't actually find out the man's name because he says his name is Slade when he hires the room in the Bonting family house. He's got two rooms. He's got one as lodgings and one as a laboratory. Because he comes around the corner in the fog at a place called Slade Walk, and obviously he's adopted the name, so we don't actually find out the character's real name. He goes and lives with the Bonting family. Sir Cedric Hardwicke plays Robert Bonting, the father of the family. Sarah Allgood, an Irish actor who is really, really good, plays Mrs. Bonting, who ultimately starts unravelling the threads that lead us to believe that Slade is Jack the Ripper. Then we get Merle Oberon, the star of the piece, ostensibly, as Kitty Langley, the niece of Mrs. Bonting, who's a music hall performer and does kind of a can-can kind of deal in the local hippodrome. Merle Oberon's an interesting actor who has an unusual association with Australia. When I was a kid, we were told by her PR people from the 1940s till the 1970s that Merle Oberon was actually Tasmanian, as was Errol Flynn. And so Australia kind of adopted her. You got to remember, this is before you could look things up online. There were only newspaper archives and birth records and things like that, and they were quite hard to access. So people thought she was Australian, and they kind of adopted her as an Australian actor. Turns out that the truth is a lot more complicated than that. She was actually Anglo-Indian, so she was part Indian, part English. And because of that, what they saw as miscegenation at the time, she hid her heritage from the public and from Hollywood itself. And so she made up this bullshit story that she was actually Tasmanian, which was anything but the truth. And in spite of all that, she was quite good as Kitty. She does the music hall bits, her voice is dubbed, but there's a can-can song and dance number. And she's no better or worse than she has to be really for the role, but she does have a certain empathy for the character of Slade, who kind of intrigues her in a non-sexual way. She's more interested in Inspector Hardwick, played by George Sanders, who is the police detective who, of course, has attracted her because she's a very attractive woman. She's a music hall person. And takes her to visit the Black Museum at Scotland Yard, which is quite a gory museum with artifacts of various murders and death masks of murderers and all sorts of things like that. So they kind of build a relationship on that, while Slade slowly reveals who he is, mostly to Mrs. Bonting. He's got this weird and disturbing obsession with his late brother. His late brother kind of associated with low-class women and became an alcoholic and died. But Slade himself has, when he talks about his brother and shows Mrs. Bonting a photo of him, he has this weird obsession with his brother, how beautiful his brother was, how magnificent, how godlike he was. There's a sexual and also a incestuous affection that Slade has for his brother. And Laird Craig plays that in a really interesting way. He's kind of pathetic. He shows that the character can love somebody, but the kind of love he has is, well, for a start, it's homosexual, which at the time was monstrous according to most people. And of course, it's also incestuous, which is still beyond the pale. And one of the problems Craig had as a person, which kind of rolls into this, and which he probably used to help him with the role, is that being a gay man, he saw himself as a pervert and as a grotesque. His physicality didn't help with that kind of self-analysis. But at the time, he saw himself, from what we understand, as a sick individual. Even though he was quite charming and pleasant and a nice person, the way he saw himself rather than the way other people saw him was in a very negative light. And that's going to kind of roll into what I say further about his life a little bit more when I talk about Hangover Square. One of the other things I really liked about the movie, and I kind of got to thank a lot of my feminist friends for kind of giving me the perception to see this, is the relationship between the women who live in the streets, who ultimately some of them become the victims of Jack the Ripper. There are a few characters, Doris Lloyd playing a character called Jenny, Helena Pickard playing Annie Rowley, one of the victims of Jack the Ripper, who was actually the wife of Sir Cedric Hardwick, and a couple of other people around the music halls and around the streets. There are some really nice roles for women in this film. They're mostly older women too, which is kind of cool because a lot of Hollywood didn't kind of give an internal life to older women characters. But these women who were basically living some, they couldn't really say prostitution in 1944 American films, but they were kind of women living on the streets and drunks. And they were kind of, you see a little bit of them helping each other. One of them borrows a squeeze box organ from another one so she can make a bit of money busking on the streets to give herself a week's lodging and food and things like that. and her friend lends it to her. There's kind of a whole network of relationships which are much more interesting than the relationships between the rich people, the Bonting family. Interesting though they are, aren't as interesting as the street singers and the buskers and the drunks and the pub dwellers of London. They really do get an internal life in this, and it really does give a lot of flesh to the bone of this movie. And some of the thanks to that has to go to the director, John Brahm, with whom Craig I had a kind of mixed relationship during Hangover Square. They had some severe arguments, and Craig I said he'd never work with Brahm again. And then, of course, they had to do retakes of some scenes, so he had to work with Brahm again. But Brahm was another one of those guys who worked in theatre in Berlin and was a director of acting troops and all sorts of things in Berlin in the 1920s. With the rise of Hitler, he left the country and moved to England. Worked as a movie production supervisor there. He got a chance to direct a remake of Broken Blossoms in 1936. And then he moved to the US, got a bit of a career with Columbia Pictures before moving on to 20th Century Fox. After his movie career, Brahm did a lot of episodic television. He did episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents and The Twilight Zone and things like that. But there are some interesting films he did make. There was Tonight We Raid Calais, kind of wartime dramas. The Locket in 1946, which you really have to see. It's a film noir about a woman with a really interesting mental illness. He did The Brasher Doubloon with George Montgomery, which was an adaptation of a Raymond Chandler novel. He did The Miracle of Our Lady of Fatima, which was a kind of epic starring Gilbert Roland about a girl who sees a vision of the Virgin Mary in Spain. He did The Mad Magician with Vincent Price in 1934. But apart from that, he didn't kind of do a lot of really interesting work apart from Hangover Square and The Lodger. Now, The Lodger kind of ends in an interesting way in the theatre, where Slade tries to kill Kitty because she's a painted, tainted woman and, yeah, is as fucked up as anybody in movie history. And we do get to see a change. There's a really interesting last scene with Slade where we get to see him kind of change from those softly spoken and deeply twisted person into a trapped animal. And Laird Cragar really does play that well. The music stops entirely during that scene when the police are surrounding Slade at a window. And the editing of the film at that stage is punctuated by the gasping deep breathing of Slade, and they do it really nicely. It's a lovely scene, and Laird Cragar's acting is physical, and a lot of it's in his face. His eyes bug out, his cheeks, his head trembles. It's a really interesting portrayal, and it shows how deeply sick and twisted this man is in a way that we hadn't seen previously in the film. And he ultimately dies, which is no surprise to anybody. But there's a kind of eulogy to him in an odd way. And there's a kind of recognition that he isn't evil, but he's deeply mentally ill, which is slightly unusual for a lot of films around that time, for the simple reason that good versus evil in that Judeo-Christian way is too much of a theme in so many movies, and such a simplistic answer to something as complex as the human mind, that movies that avoid it have, by the very fact that they avoid it and acknowledge the complexity of human existence, give us a much deeper experience. Because good versus evil is like, you know, a non-off switch, but there are shades of grey in this movie which are really kind of interesting, and also that occur in a much more powerful way in Hangover Square. But The Lodger, it's a really great movie. I love the kind of layering. I like the set design. I like the fact that even though some of the Cockney accents are a little bit ropey, I do like the life on the streets as much as I like the life in the townhouses for the more wealthy people. In this one, it does give us a kind of capsule London, which is not anywhere near like London really is, but is a kind of Hollywood-fied London, but nonetheless has its own charm. and a vividness that I really appreciated. So anyway, I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, I'm going to talk about the second of the two films, Hangover Square from 1945, which stars Leg Craigile with Linda Darnell and again George Sanders. And again, it's directed by John Brahm.
Some people go for funny drinks and down and by the pail, like coffee, cocoa, tea and milk and even Adam's ale. For my part, they can keep the lot. I never would complain. I wouldn't touch the bloomin' stuff. I only drink champagne. For Champagne Charlie is my name. Champagne drinking is my game. Fizz, I'll drink every drop there is. All round town it is the same. I pop, 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 I rose to fame. I'm the idol of the barmaids, and Champagne Charlie is my name.
My famous title through a hobby which I've got. I'll never let the artist pay, however long the shot.
Whoever drinks at my expense has no need to complain. For everyone I treat alike, I make them drink champagne. Champagne Charlie is my name. Champagne drinking is my game. There's no drink as good as fizz. I'll drink every drop there is. All round town it is the same. I pop, 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 I rose to fame. I'm the idol of the barmaids, and champagne Charlie is my name. Champagne Charlie is my name. That's my name. Champagne drinking is my game. There's no drink as good as fizz. I'll drink every drop there is. All round town it is the same. I pop, 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 I roast to fame. Champagne Charlie is my name. I'm the idol of the barmaids, and Champagne Charlie is my name.
That, of course, was Edward Woodward singing Champagne Charlie, which I thought would get you in a bit of a music hall mood, because both of the movies this time around are partly set in music halls. Now, we're on to Hangover Square. Now, I picked up a copy of Hangover Square by a slightly unusual method. My friend Trevor had a friend who was getting rid of boxes and boxes of DVDs and giving them to Trevor. So Trevor and I met for lunch with his partner Sue Ann and with Sally. And he dumped a box of DVDs on me, which is something I'm never reluctant to accept. I did weed out the ones I wanted. There were some that I already had, some that weren't particularly of interest to me. And among the ones that was a US pressing of Hangover Square with Laird Craigar, which is the reason this whole podcast has come together. So thanks, Trevor. Anytime you want to lay a box of books on me, even though Sally will complain about us not having any space, I'll accept them and pass on any that I don't want. This one said a little later than the lodger. It's in the summer of 1903. A shop owner in Fulham is stabbed to death in his own shop, and the shop is set on fire by distinguished composer George Harvey Bone, played by Leigh Craigar. Now, I'm reading this from Wikipedia, who stumbles into the street in a stupor. George eventually makes his way back to his apartment in 12 Hangover Square in Chelsea to find his girlfriend, Barbara Chapman, Faye Marlowe, and her father, Sir Henry Chapman, played by Alan Napier, who was later Alfred in the Batman TV series in the 1960s. Great distinguished character actor who isn't given a lot to do in this one, but does it well. George says to Barbara that he has a whole day missing from his memory. The newspaper has stories on the murder, and George goes to see Dr. Alan Middleton, George Sanders, who works at Scotland Yard. Bone tells Middleton that he's stressed and overworked, and he suffers from periods of amnesia brought on by discordant sounds. Dr. Middleton says to him he's got to get out and not be stressed out. He's working too hard on his musical scores. He just kind of needs to relax and chill out for a little bit, which is not bad advice. So George goes to a smoking concert in a working-class pub, and he meets a singer called Netta Longdon, played by Linda Darnell, via his buddy Mickey. Netta lives in the square, but she's kind of a middling talent in the music hall scene. But along with Mickey's help, she finds a way to adapt Bone's music for her own needs. So Mickey writes the lyrics, Bone writes the music, and Netta sings the songs and becomes kind of famous. Now, Bone is enamored of Netta, of course, but she is a player of sorts. And one of the people she's a player with, oddly enough, is an actor called Glenn Langham, playing a character called Eddie Carstairs. Decade later, working for Burt I. Gordon, Langham becomes the amazing colossal man in that 1950s science fiction movie. So that's just a side note. Inevitably, George finds out about Netta being unfaithful to him and strangles her to death and disposes of the body in a really interesting way. I'm not going to spoil that for you. He ultimately gets found out and has a really, really weird and wonderful death scene, which, again, I'm not going to spoil for you. You really should check out Hangover Square and kind of look at it for yourself. Now, this was a bit of a passion project for Krager because he liked the original book, which was based by a guy called Patrick Hamilton, Hangover Square, 1941 novel. Krager liked the novel and wanted to do it as a follow-up to The Lodger, and it is a sequential, it's a pretty good follow-up to The Lodger. And so he convinced Fox to buy the rights and to let them film it. Now, there were some problems during the production, and most of them were to do with Laird Krager himself. He wanted to lose a lot of weight. He wanted to be a leading man. That was his big ambition, is to be a leading man in the movies, and why not? So he went on a crash diet. He really kind of hit it hard. They filmed the movie in sequence because his weight kept dropping, and if they kind of did it out of sequence, that would look very kind of clashy. And one of the other problems that Krager had was he was using amphetamines to help with the diet. That was a well-known way of dieting at the time. You change your eating habits and you take amphetamines. Not the best thing for somebody who's working, and also not the best thing for somebody in general. I've only ever really had amphetamines once. And to be honest with you, I'm much more a coffee guy than the kind of hard, jagged edge you get from amphetamines. It's definitely not my kind of drugs. But the problem there is, of course, that amphetamine use leads to erratic behavior. So Brahm, the director, and Krager clashed. And one of the things Brahm did, he got the cast and crew to sign a document stating that they were on Brahm's side and not on Krager's side in the arguments that Krager had with his director. And, you know, that again, that's kind of really fucked up in a number of ways. But leaving that aside, the movie looks great. It's got that same production value, in fact, a bit better production value than The Lodger had. And it's also got a really good score by Bernard Herrmann, who created the music that Bone composes in the film, and that in itself has led to the movie being very influential on a very important late 20th century composer. Stephen Sondheim said that Bernard Herrmann's score for Hangover Square was a major influence on Sondheim's Sweeney Todd, which is one of the best late 20th century musicals, in my humble opinion. And I can definitely see the influence there, the use of discordant music, the dark intensity of it. Forget the Johnny Depp, Tim Burton, Sweeney Todd. If you look on YouTube, you can probably find either the Len Carreyrou version or the George Hearn version of Sweeney Todd. They did film the stage versions of them. and it's chalk and cheese. The Tim Burton version is watered down lolly water compared to the originals. And I've seen Sweeney Todd on the stage, I think, three times now over the years. And it's never less than mesmerizing and a horror thing. Now, there is a funny thing. I'm going to digress here because it's my podcast and I can digress. I saw Sweeney Todd done by an amateur theatre production here in Melbourne with a friend I went to the thing with because she was into musicals, and indeed as am I. And so there's an amateur theatre production of Sweeney Todd. Now, one of the things, of course, is the straight razor Sweeney Todd uses, and to do that on stage, you need a razor with a hidden squirt thing that squirts the blood across the people's throats as Sweeney Todd cuts throats on stage. Now, there was a malfunction with the razor, and all the blood hit the guy who was supposed to have his throat cut up near his ear hole rather than across his throat. So the guy immediately puts his hand up to his ear and smears the blood across his throat in a really nice bit of a save there. And it was worked really well. Live theatre is an interesting thing. When something goes wrong and somebody improvises, the audience automatically increases the love it has for the production. When somebody kind of does that, you go, oh, wonderful. And there was much kind of an elevated mood among the audience for the rest of the production because, we were waiting to see if anything else fucked up. And B, we liked the way that the actors covered when something did fuck up. So that's just a bit of a digression. Happened once and another time when I saw a stage production of La Cage aux Folles, and the stage was hinged in the centre and kind of to make it easier to get off the stage during other scenes. There was a hinge in the centre of the stage. It was in two parts. And the platform they were dancing on suddenly started parting, and all the dancers had to leap over this increasingly large gap between the two halves of the set. And at the next scene, you could hear the stage people going clunk, clunk, clunk while they were putting the set back together. It was very, very funny. But anyway, Hangover Square. The Bones, a very different character to Slade in The Lodger. He's a much more sympathetic character, and also because of Laird Craigar's weight loss and the fact that he was trying to make the character of Bone a little bit of a kind of tragic romantic lead. And I can understand why he really did have kind of body images, as we now call them. And one of the problems there, of course, is that Hollywood, particularly at the time, typecast actors, particularly during the studio system, and they had him typecast as a grotesque, as a murderer, as a character actor who could play a wide range of roles, which is something he could definitely do. But Craigar had a different image for himself, which was not only at odds with his physical characteristics, but at odds with the way the industry in which he worked operated. And that kind of works in this one because there's a kind of mental illness. I mean, I'm not going to try to diagnose it, I'm not an expert, but the mental illness that Bone manifests, which is triggered as a kind of fugue when he hears discordant noises. In one case, it's a bunch of pipes falling on the ground. In other cases, it's other things. But he becomes, it's almost a Jekyll and Hyde thing, but not quite. It isn't done with chemicals. It's done with brain chemistry. But he's really great at playing the sympathetic and artistic, but romantically maladroit Bone, and also playing the grotesque monster he becomes when he's in this weird and homicidal fugue state that he has. And that's not an easy ask for any actor to play kind of sympathetic. He really seemed to, in these last two films, play in a weird way and in a very dark way sympathetic monsters. Even though they murder people, and even though there's a wide streak of misogyny, particularly in Slade, you still find him a sympathetic character because Laird Craigar's personality was a sympathetic one. Here's George Harvey Bone. Is a character who really, you know, he's artistic, he's earnest, he's happy to please, and he's really not good with women, because his girlfriend he kind of dumps when Linda Darnell's character is around. And yet we very much understand why Barbara is attracted to him. He's a nice guy in a lot of ways. And the movie then, as a part of that, has a not unsympathetic approach to mental illness. There's not this good versus evil dichotomy. There's definitely a kind of understanding that this is something of a disease for Bone rather than something he is because he's an evil person. And that makes it really a lot more complex and plays better to a 21st century audience. So 2 months before the movie came out, Laird Craigard died of a heart attack at the age of 31, probably because of the amphetamines and the torture he put his body through in the weight loss he was undergoing in order to try to be a leading man actor, which is really sad because some people have said that had he lived, Laird Craigard may have had a career kind of like the one that Vincent Price ended up having if he had have just kind of embraced the things that he was good at. But he didn't see it that way, and he had every right to be that way. But it ultimately, his obsession with transforming himself, and he was going to undergo plastic surgery, do all sorts of things like that were in his plans. Ultimately, it led to his premature death. And that's a shame because I like him as an actor. I think he is a great actor. His charisma, his kind of larger-than-life persona really lended itself well to the screen. And like a lot of other people who die early, people like Heath Ledger, of course, and maybe even River Phoenix, though his potential is something that I'm kind of a little bit oblivious to, I think that Laird Craigard could have really had an interesting career that would have given us as audiences some really fascinating and thrilling bits of cinema. So, yeah, it's a missed opportunity for Hollywood, but, of course, it's a major tragedy for Craigard himself. So, yeah, I'm kind of glad I did this one because I think that he is somebody that we need to note in the podcast because of that brief career but very interesting one that he had. I think my favourite role is him playing His Excellency the Devil in Heaven Can Wait, because there's a really contrary warmth and politeness and courtesy about his devil, which is unlike any other portrayal of Satan that I've seen in cinema. It really does make me like the actor a lot. And even though he did have these roles where he played misogynistic killers in a couple of things, while doing so, he managed to keep our sympathy for him as a character. And I really like that. It's the more I watch of movies and the more I watch new films and old films as well, the more I love watching actors who are very good at a specific thing or a range of things. I'm fascinated with the idea of acting and the way that certain actors can give us incredible insights into the human heart and the human character. It isn't to say I don't like action sequences and dumb movies, because I do, but now and then it's a different experience to watch a movie with really interesting actors doing interesting things in interesting ways than watching an action film. It's a bit like there's music that you get down in the mosh pit and headbang to, and there's music you sit back in an armchair with a brandy and listen to. They're very different experiences, and you have very different approaches to absorb in the art. And Laird Craigard's character roles are quite unlike any others. So that's about it this time around. I will be back with another Paleo Cinema podcast next week, another Martian Drive-In podcast in 2 weeks. I'm putting up a YouTube video in the next couple of days about my 5 worst fathers in movie history, because Father's Day is coming up on the weekend, and one of the things YouTube tells me is topical is important. So take care of yourselves. Watch some good movies, watch some bad movies. Definitely watch Hangover Square if you possibly can, and Heaven Can Wait, and The Lodger, and even The Black Swan. I've done that before. Don't know whether you've done that, but have you ever watched a movie for one character actor's bit in it? Because I do that a little bit, and I kind of like it. I don't feel guilty about it at all. But I like the idea of watching a movie for one person's work and just seeing how well they do it. So again, thank you to David Kummer for supporting the podcast through Patreon and all of the other podcast supporters. Still haven't got around to redoing the end credits for the podcast because real life has interfered once again. Anyway, take care of yourselves and I'll talk to you very soon. And again, go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. If you look at the YouTube video, please leave a like and also leave some comments in it because it does help get more visibility for the stuff I'm putting out there. I'll catch you guys later. Here are the credits for Paleo Cinema Podcast and Martian Drive-In Podcast done in the style of film credits. I'd like to thank Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, the prop master, Morris, our musical director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, the casting director, Chris, the camera operator, Christopher, the gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our Foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, the second unit director, Paul, the special makeup effects director, Tammy, the donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve Sullivan, our script doctor, Dylan, the goat wrangler, Eric, the set security lead, Richard H., the set photographer, Mark D., the extra, David L., the extra, and Richard C., our transport co-captain, plus Andrew, our necessary film critic. We have Kerry H., our accountant, and Kerry L., our other spiritual advisor. Thank you so much to all the patrons for dipping into their pockets and helping out with the podcast. This has been a Paleo Cinema Martian Drive-In production. The end.